Hello everyone and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. We've got an especially special treat for you today. A new first time co-host on the show, although someone that you might recognize from our interview about a week ago. Bridget Todd joins us for the first time. How's it going, Bridget?
It's going well. I'm so excited to be here.
Very excited to have you here. Weird day of news for you to be joining us for, but some important stories that we're going to be talking about. Some abhorrent individuals we're going to be talking about. So I hope it's stuff that you'll find intriguing.
I always find abhorrent individuals intriguing, for sure.
Me too. Well, then you chose a good political system to comment on constantly. So for people who might not be familiar with you and your work, or perhaps your podcast, There Are No Girls on the Internet, tell us a little bit about your work.
Yeah, I am the communications director for Ultraviolet, a leading national gender justice organization that works to build political and social power for women and non-binary folks. So definitely check us out at weareultraviolet.org. And I'm also the creator and host of iHeartRadio's technology podcast, There Are No Girls on the Internet, where we explore all the interesting intersections of culture and underrepresented voices and tech and all things geeky.
And so for people who may not get the reference in the title, could you explain why it's called There Are No Girls on the Internet?
Oh yes, well that is one of the founding, you know, rules of the internet, that anybody that you meet on there who says they're a girl is not actually a girl. And if you do say that you're a girl, you need to prove that you're a girl in some way. The title is really kind of an inside joke with myself as someone who loves to be online, who's often experienced people saying, oh, there are no girls on the internet. Yes, there are, we exist, we're out here.
Yeah, well, and it's funny that you say that, because one of our stories today is gonna be about the experience of a girl on the internet who, simply for being on the internet and wanting to not be harassed, is, what do you know, being harassed far more. So very timely title, but again, very glad to have you here. Think the audience is going to really appreciate your contributions. And to the audience, thank you so much for being here, regardless of where you're watching. We really do appreciate you doing so. Please hit the like button and share the stream so that people know we're live. Give unto the algorithm gods, please. And as we go through this hour of news, if you want to send us tweets or chats or twitchies or ticks or talks, you can do that. We'll respond live if you have any questions or anything like that. And all together, we should have a lot of fun. But with that, Bridget, you ready to jump into the news?
Let's do it.
Okay, let's do it. So the COVID aid bill has now passed, and it passed notably without any Republican support. But you wouldn't necessarily know that to talk to the Republicans about it, because we noticed yesterday this tweet from Senator Roger Wicker, who said independent restaurant operators have won nearly $29 billion worth of targeted relief. This funding will ensure small businesses can survive the pandemic by helping to adapt their operations and keep their employees on the payroll. And I'm sure, Bridget, that if he had more than 280 characters, he would have then noted that he didn't vote for the bill. He, if he had had his way, would have blocked every one of those $29 billion. But if you just read this, and you're maybe a small business owner in his state, it looks like he actually supports you.
Yeah, I mean, this is a classic example of them wanting to have it both ways, right? He didn't vote for it and yet wants credit for the kind of help it's going to give his constituents. And I think it's worth noting that no Republicans voted for this. You know, the aid that's meant to help hardworking American families, many of whom are struggling, who need relief, none of them voted for it. And so it's very interesting to me how they're trying to take credit for something that they did not even vote for.
Exactly, exactly. Well, like subtly take credit for it. They're also, like, credit is definitely what the next couple of months are gonna be about in politics, is who deserves credit, who doesn't. In some ways, like with Senator Roger Wicker, they might imply that they do deserve credit for that. But then they're also simultaneously gonna be trying to claim that the Democrats don't, which we'll turn to in just a moment. But really fast, Roger Wicker's tweet was so obviously fake and phony. He got such a big pushback online. He was asked about it by reporters and he later said, well, I'm not gonna vote for 1.9 trillion just because it has a couple of good provisions.
I mean, does he care about the people in his community getting help or not, right? It's like, you really cannot have it both ways, I feel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and look, he might have, like, if we're giving him more, like an assumption of operating in good faith that he almost certainly isn't, maybe he has some other bill that he imagines would have been better. And in theory, if we had a functioning democracy with two serious political parties, they might have met in the middle in some way on those bills. But Roger Wicker, apparently, if he's operating in good faith there, is running up against the Republican strategy, the natural outcome of the Republican strategy, where they're never gonna vote for anything the Democrats do, no matter how pro anything it is. And if you go into this legislative session making clear that the opposition knows that you're not gonna operate in good faith with them, well, then they're not gonna give you much. I mean, I would argue the Democrats kind of did anyway, but they have no real incentive to, because Roger Wicker was never gonna vote for that. If it was 1 trillion or 500 billion or 100 billion, he cares more about denying Biden a legislative win than he does about small business relief or any other component of this.
Oh, absolutely. And let's not forget, Democrats voted for the CARES Act, right? Like, this is not something that goes both ways. I think it's so clear that this is really about making sure that Biden doesn't get what they see as some sort of legislative win. And the people who I feel really get lost in that is just regular people. You know, they don't care if this is a Biden win or a Republican win, a Democratic win. People need help. People are struggling. I think that, you know, I feel that we often are like, oh, both sides do this. It's very clear which side is not interested in getting anything done. I think that's overwhelmingly clear.
Exactly. Yeah. All last year, the Republicans were implying that every part of the pandemic was designed to hurt the Republicans. And the Democrats cared more about that than they did about anything else. And yet, as you point out, they did support the CARES Act. It's sort of weird and inconsistent, but I have a feeling that the Republicans will be able to make those ends meet in their head. And by the way, in terms of the hypocrisy between these two bills and how it doesn't go both ways, one thing that does go both ways is that both this legislation and the CARES Act included the possibility that the incarcerated might get stimulus checks. Interestingly, Republicans like Tom Cotton, who voted for the earlier CARES Act that did that, is now criticizing this one for saying, look at these damn Democrats trying to give money to prisoners. But you supported it when it was Trump. It's just, it's like the cake is hypocrisy, the filling is hypocrisy, the frosting is hypocrisy, the whole thing just sucks.
It's hypocrisy all the way down, just the whole thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's really frustrating. But look, that is sort of them wanting to get a little bit of credit. But they also, perhaps more importantly, want to make sure that the Democrats don't get credit. So with it looking, I guess, like the economy is going to pick up in no small part thanks to $2 trillion in relief being put into it, Mitch McConnell wants to make sure that you don't make the mistake of giving the Democrats any credit, as he makes clear in this video.
The economy is coming back, people are getting vaccine. We're on the way out of this. We're about to have a boom. And if we do have a boom, it will have absolutely nothing to do with this $1.9 trillion.
Yeah, but that's stupid though. Like, look, you can say that it could have been targeted in a slightly better way or something, but if you're gonna make the case that injecting $2 trillion into the economy, and into the economy, by the way, not for instance a $2 trillion tax cut for the wealthy, you're gonna send it to the Caymans or whatever, then you're gonna have to explain why. Why is it that they could put all that money in the economy and it would seemingly have no effect on the economy? Now, that politically that might be helpful for people to come to that conclusion, but you need to actually provide some evidence for it. And it seems clear that the more important thing to Mitch McConnell, even more important than people getting aid, since he wasn't interested in supporting this bill, is just making sure that this doesn't bolster Democratic chances over the next year, like sort of setting the stage for midterms that might not be as devastating for them as I fear that they probably will be.
Yeah, and I have to say, Mitch McConnell says that this bill is not going to have any impact on the economy. Analysis from Columbia says otherwise. And so just like you said, if he knows something that Columbia doesn't know and all of the major, you know, pollsters and analyzers who study this kind of thing don't know, please enlighten me on what it is that means that this bill is not going to do what they say for the economy. But you know, it really is. It's so interesting how he's able to say, you know, oh, if it goes well, that's definitely the Republicans. If it doesn't do well, that's all Democrats. It's like you definitely get the sense that he wants it both ways. He wants credit, and then he also wants to deny, you know, it really is so hypocritical. And it's so obvious. It's like he's not even trying to pretend.
Yeah, it's possible that to some extent, when he talks about the economy, he's sort of like he has certain assumptions as a Republican about what counts as the economy and what doesn't count as the economy. So if studies show that this is gonna cut a significant percentage of poverty over the next year, like percentage of people living in poverty, I doubt he's really centering that in his conversations about the economy.
Oh yeah.
But in the end, it's not like the stock market isn't gonna benefit. They always do, regardless of which party is in power. So again, it just seems sort of it's pointless political strategizing. That's pretty much all it is. But I did want to ask you a question though. So he seems to be betraying that he's worried about voters looking back on this and giving Biden a bunch of credit and the Democrats a bunch of credit. Do you think that like in nearly 2 years, or like say a year and a half, as we're in the thick of the midterms, is this still gonna be, you think, like central on people's minds? Is this gonna be a big consideration?
I don't know. That's a great question. I think it's clear that the Republicans are very concerned about it. I happen to think that, voters have a pretty, like they care how things impact them. I think that, you know, for a lot of people, this is not about politics or playing politics. I think people just want help. They want help. They want care. They want, you know, aid. They want relief, especially right now with so many people struggling. I think that they might be overthinking how much your average American is kind of read into the politics of how things get done. They just want things to get done.
Yeah. Well, we'll have to see. Anyway, at least from the Republicans' point of view, they seem pretty united on this. I mean, you have someone like Mitch McConnell wanting to make sure, you know, that people don't, they see how popular the bill is, even amongst a majority of Republicans actually support it, let alone Democrats or independents. But even people like Liz Cheney, who the Republicans would love to run out of the party, says this bill does far more harm than good, and the damage it does will only make our recovery efforts more difficult. So I don't know, maybe she actually believes that, maybe she's a true believer on the fact that we should never stimulate the economy by giving money to the working class, but maybe it's just the Republicans can be in lockstep on certain things, like don't give any credit to the Democrats. I don't know.
Yeah, and it's funny. I think that you're so right earlier when you said, you know, I think that some of these Republicans see the economy as like rich guys and corporations. And, you know, listen, those people are going to get theirs regardless. Why not have give money to just everyday Americans who are struggling? I think that you're exactly right that when some of these people say the economy, I think it's kind of clear who that includes and who that leaves out. But yeah, I think this bill, before it was passed, I think it had 75% of Americans like approved of it. How often do you get 75% of anybody agreeing on anything? That's a pretty huge number to me.
Yeah, exactly. When look, we've had a couple of months of right-wing media demonizing COVID aid. You have the Democrats really tragically backing off of some of the earlier promises they'd made. These are all things that in theory could have led people to be a little bit muddled about their view of the bill. And yet it seems like they still kind of like it. What do you know? People want help during this terrible crisis. Now, there's another area of credit that I want to talk about though. As this COVID aid bill is being passed, and in the context of more and more vaccinations being done every day, and this should help, some of the money is going towards that. And we have more news coming up on vaccination as well. There is one individual who wants to make sure that he gets some credit in this, and that is Donald Trump, who doesn't have social media, but has apparently found, I guess, a loophole, because it turns out you could release a press release that is effectively just a tweet, almost down to the specific length of it as well. Now, in general, I'm not gonna be interested in this sort of thing, but this one in particular is pretty funny, so I have to read this. This is a statement by the 45th president of the United States of America. I hope everyone remembers when they're getting the COVID-19, often referred to as the China virus vaccine, that if I wasn't president, you wouldn't be getting that beautiful shot for 5 years at best, and probably wouldn't be getting it at all. I hope everyone remembers this has been your president, Donald J. Trump. No, he didn't have that part, but that was the whole press release. The whole press release was, oh God.
There's so much. First of all, this is the saddest thing I've ever seen in my life. On the day when, you know, we get this massive COVID relief passed, he basically is reminding people, you know what I have to offer? Racism. You know, he cannot back away from this like quote unquote China virus, you know, idea. And again, I think it's clear that he really misses Twitter. He's trying to find all these little ways to get his message out there. It's just, honestly, it makes me sad. And again, like, I almost kind of forgot about how just strange of a guy Trump is. Beautiful shot. Like, even the way he describes it is like, oh yeah, he described everything as beautiful.
Just like they stick it in, beautiful. That was amazing. Gorgeous. Love it. Yeah, it should be fake. That should be a fake statement that we just read. I don't think it is. I'm gonna continue to hope that it is. But here's the thing. Trump wants credit. Now, does he deserve at least a little bit of credit? Hypothetically, we've given him some hypothetical credit on this over the past few months. Did they provide some funding towards some but not all of the vaccines? Yes. Would literally any president have done so? 100%. He provided nothing additional over and above what a random coma patient as president would have. And yet he wants special credit. And again, like we said, he's saying there, if he hadn't done giving taxpayer money, it would have been 5 years or maybe never that we would have gotten it, even though some of the vaccines didn't receive any funding and the beautiful shots are still going into arms regardless.
It's so ridiculous. And this statement like conveniently leaves out all of the ridiculous bogus cures that he threw money at and advocated for that ended up being complete bunk. You know, it's like, it's so clear that he bungled the response in so many different ways. It's very funny now trying to remind people to like, oh, give me some credit here. It just, yeah, it's just, I wish this was fake. It should be fake.
It should be. And the weird thing is like, I'm criticizing that he wants credit, that he wants everyone to associate him with the beautiful shot. But the thing is, honestly, I would prefer that what the sort of weird psychological impulse that he's demonstrating in the statement, that he was consistent on it, that he always wanted credit on the shot, that he was always clear that the shot was great and that everyone should get it. But the thing is, that's not where we're at. In statements like this, he's saying nobody would be getting the shot if I hadn't done it, give me credit. And yet, he doesn't seem generally to want to be associated with it, certainly not in direct ways that would lead some of his fans, which I have to assume anti-vaxxers are now overrepresented in. So for instance, we found out a couple weeks ago that he had been vaccinated back in January, him and Melania both, but they didn't reveal it. They tried to keep it hidden as long as possible. And so now, I believe as of today, we have this new PSA featuring every living president with one notable exception, trying to get as many people as possible to be as desperate as possible to get this vaccine as fast as possible so we can go back to normal as quickly as possible. Here's that PSA.
Right now, the COVID-19 vaccines are available to millions of Americans, and soon they will be available to everyone.
This vaccine means hope. It will protect you and those you love from this dangerous and deadly disease.
I want to go back to work and I want to be able to move around.
To visit with Michelle's mom, to hug her and see her on her birthday.
You know what I'm really looking forward to is going to opening day in Texas Ranger Stadium with a full stadium.
We've lost enough people and we've suffered enough damage.
In order to get rid of this pandemic, it's important for our fellow citizens to get vaccinated.
I'm getting vaccinated because we want this pandemic to end as soon as possible.
So we urge you to get vaccinated when it's available to you.
So roll up your sleeve and do your part.
This is our shot.
Now it's up to you.
Credit could he have gotten if he had just appeared in that, I guess. I would have given him credit for trying to get some of the people he's convinced not to trust things like the vaccine. If he'd just appeared in that, if he had let people know that he was getting it. It seems like that would have been more efficient.
I completely agree. Like it's missing an easy layup. And so you have to ask like, well, clearly he doesn't care about what the greater good is. You know, when I watched that video, it's like, oh, this is a collection of adults who are all coming together for the greater good to help people get vaccinated and let them know it's okay. Trump couldn't do that. He couldn't even be bothered to be in this video. He couldn't be bothered to take a selfie when he got his vaccine so that someone out there who, you know, takes their cues from him and his base would be like, oh, maybe I should get vaccinated. It's the literal least he could do, and he can't do it.
Exactly. And of course, and like we shouldn't have to reiterate this yet again. The point is to get as many people as possible. Like some people, you know, there are terrible people online, some of which might even believe that they're liberals or progressives or whatever. They'll be like, well, if they don't want to, screw them. If Texas doesn't want the vaccine, screw them. No, they're good people everywhere. And you know what? Even people who aren't good, shouldn't die of a virus. And so, like, I don't want Republicans to die. That's why we spent the last year every day fighting against Fox News misinformation, not because it was killing libs. Libs don't watch Fox News, but it was killing conservatives, and I don't want them to die.
Yeah, I'm so glad you brought that up, because I remember when they essentially reopened Texas like way too early. I saw so many people online being like, oh, well, they shouldn't get any of the vaccine. And just like you said, that completely overlooks the fact that there are people in Texas, like, it's not like your average everyday Texas citizen is in control of what Abbott does. And it doesn't mean that they should not have access to the healthcare that they need to keep them safe and keep them from dying from COVID. Like, that is completely the wrong way to think about it. I completely agree. I think that everybody, Republican, Democrat, wherever you fall, needs healthcare, needs access to the vaccine, and should not be dying a preventative death from COVID. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And if that's not convincing to you, if like you're like, no, I still hate them, bear in mind, if conservatives get sick with it, they can give it to non-conservatives. Yes. So again, our fates are very much interwoven in this area.
Exactly.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
you must unlearn what you have learned.
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Yesterday, President Joe Biden announced that in addition to the already established contracts for a variety of different vaccines, he is going to be directing the federal government to secure an additional 100 million doses of Johnson & Johnson's COVID-19 single shot vaccine. And we mentioned that it's the single shot one because that means that 100 million doses is a very significant investment. It's a very significant amount. I mean, that's about a third of the entire US population could be vaccinated with that particular order. But in addition to that, since you've probably done some of the math yourself over the past few months, we've now ordered far more shots than would actually be required to vaccinate all of America even if we didn't have 30% of the country, which would rather be shot in the head than vaccinated because of what they've been told by Fox News, which means that we will have extra, which means that if the US has leftover vaccines, once every American has had the opportunity to get a jab, that's from the Independent, they're British, the Biden administration will share its inventory with the rest of the world, he announced yesterday. Bridget, what do you think about that?
I think it's the right move. You know, so many other countries, I know that Mexico needs vaccines. Like, I definitely think it's the right move to share our surplus with other countries that need it, because as you said, you know, this is a communicable disease. And so if we need everybody to get vaccines, we need everybody to be protected because they spread. It doesn't matter, you know, it borders don't work that way. The virus doesn't care about, you know, where you live. That's how communicable diseases work. So I think it's definitely the right move. I'm very excited.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And look, in terms of making it slightly safer, let's say for Americans to travel abroad, you would want other areas to be vaccinated. Business is inherently international. So American businesses are going to be affected by how much COVID there is in other countries. So even if you were being like heartlessly pragmatic, for those reasons, I think it would be a good thing. Also, maybe would produce a little bit of goodwill, maybe could help to make up for a little bit of some of the horror that America has put out into various parts of the world over the past few decades. So I think that those would be good reasons. I would say, and I get that he's not gonna do this, I would say, couldn't we start doing that now? Like, I'm not saying take half or whatever, but couldn't we start sending some? I mean, we did a segment on, I think it was something like 25 different countries that hadn't had any vaccines administered yet. And I think Ghana had like 25, not 1,000, like 25 vaccines. Like, I feel like we could do some goodwill by sending it over there.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's exactly right. I think that we do have a little bit of work to do in terms of repairing our reputation with the rest of the world. Like, let's be clear. And I think this could be a good first step, a good show of goodwill to the understanding that, yeah, we are a global economy and we're in this together. You know, I think that you're exactly right. I think that could be a good way of fostering some of that goodwill that we might have lost over the last 4 years.
Yeah. The thing is, if he were to do that, like, he's not gonna do that. If he were to do that now, can you imagine what the Republicans would say if he sent the vaccine to Mexico or to Canada? Canada's probably gonna be fine. Oh my God, if he sent it to Africa, they would lose their minds.
I mean, it's so true. And the reason why that's so sad is that kind of Republican posturing and feet dragging and temper tantrums, it really does prevent us from being able to have productive, like, meaningful conversations about how we move forward, because you're exactly right. We would never be able to do this thing that could potentially be a good thing because Republicans would pitch a fit. So it is It's interesting how it often prevents us from being able to even have the conversation about what would move us forward.
Yeah. Now, really fast, I just want to tell you the numbers to give you an idea of when people here in the US might be able to get their vaccines, when the surplus might start going abroad. Even before this most recent 100 million, the US was to have enough approved vaccine delivered by mid-May to cover every adult and enough for 400 million people total by the end of July. Enough doses to cover 200 million more people are on order should vaccines from AstraZeneca and Novavax receive approval from the Food and Drug Administration. The new J&J doses, which would cover another 100 million people, are expected to be delivered in the latter half of the year. I mean, this is a massive amount. This is like, I mean, you may have learned like in high school that the US nuclear arsenal could nuke every inch of the earth multiple times over. We could vaccinate everyone multiple times over. And so hopefully that means that there will not only be some that we can give abroad, but a lot actually. And the thing is really fast, I wanna let you know that there are countries that are already doing this. There are countries generally that are not democracies, not representative democracies, but that doesn't mean that they're not doing a great deal of good by sharing their current vaccine supply abroad. China has pledged roughly 500 million doses of its vaccine to more than 45 different countries. 4 of China's many vaccine makers are claiming they will be able to produce at least 2.6 billion doses this year, which is crazy. Russia has sent millions of doses of its vaccine to countries around the world, even as it vaccinates its own population. Israel, which has vaccinated more than half of its population with Pfizer vaccines produced in Europe, has also attempted to use vaccine diplomacy to reward allies. And so even the tenor of this particular article from the AP that we're sort of citing here is implying, well, they're just doing it because it gives them foreign influence and they can afford to do it because they're like some of these countries don't have to really be responsive to the potentially xenophobic demands of their population. But from the point of view of a person in another part of the world that gets a vaccine as a result of it, it's really all the same. Like, they get the vaccine. See, long term in terms of international politics, what effect this has, but it's important that everyone get vaccinated regardless of the motivations.
Absolutely. And I think I always think about the most marginalized folks, like folks who are incarcerated, folks who are indigenous, but communities of color. Like, I want to make sure that everybody who needs this vaccine can get it, even if you're marginalized or are kind of shut out of traditional healthcare. I want to make sure that everybody can get it, folks who are unhoused. And so when you're reading off all these numbers, I get so excited because I think like, wow, we might actually have a shot at making sure that everybody, even the most marginalized who need this vaccine, can actually get it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that 2.6 billion, if that works out, I mean that's more than China and India just from one country's contribution. So that's pretty good. Now with that, why don't we turn to a very different piece of the news? Man, sometimes the internet sucks and usually America sucks, and now like peanut butter and chocolate, they're gonna suck together. Well, actually that's not how it works. Anyway, you know what? Let's just move into the news. A couple days ago, reporter Taylor Lorenz decided for International Women's Day, she was going to make what seemed to a rational person like a pretty reasonable request. She tweeted, "For International Women's Day, please consider supporting women enduring online harassment. It's not an exaggeration to say that the harassment and smear campaign I've had to endure over the past year has destroyed my life. No one should have to go through this. So on International Women's Day, she said, please don't harass women. And so what do you think happened as a result of that? She got harassed a ton. Almost instantly, a number of very high profile accounts started tweeting nonstop about how pathetic she was. And what do you know? That led to their followers harassing her. But perhaps the single worst instance of this was Tucker Carlson, a guy who has literally millions of daily viewers, who decided that he was going to make her the focus of one of his segments, which he did, in which he called her one of the most powerful people in the world, which is an interesting claim. She's a good reporter. She's at the New York Times, which is the paper of record. Don't know that she's one of the most powerful people in the world, but he did it. Now, in response to that, the New York Times stuck up for her. And they put out a statement saying, in a now familiar move, Tucker Carlson opened his show last night by attacking a journalist. It was a calculated and cruel tactic, which he regularly deploys to unleash a wave of harassment and vitriol at his intended target. Taylor Lorenz is a talented New York Times journalist doing timely and essential reporting. Journalists should be able to do their jobs without facing harassment. Again, one of those very reasonable sorts of comments that, what do you think it led to? Well, what it led to was a second night of Tucker Carlson taking his incredibly high profile and well-paid cable news platform to talk specifically about a woman whose only request was to not be harassed. And here is a bit of what he said in the second night running of his coverage of Taylor Lorenz.
Told you about Taylor Lorenz last night in a segment about how the most privileged in our society now consider themselves oppressed. And Taylor Lorenz is certainly a shining example of that principle. A New York Times reporter from Greenwich telling you what a victim she is. Now, normally we'd be deeply sympathetic to this. Harassment is awful. Harassment is a crime, and it should be a crime. If a mob of screaming lunatics showed up at Taylor Lorenz's house and threatened her, we would condemn that mob immediately, no matter what political position they claim to represent. But that's not even close to what Taylor Lorenz is talking about. According to Taylor Lorenz, saying mean things about her on Twitter is, quote, harassment. Disagreeing with her on the internet at all is, quote, harassment. Failing to affirm her as she self-actualizes and attempts to realize her hopes and dreams in this world is, quote, harassment, and so on. There's a lot of real harassment out there. This is not it. So you can see why we included Lorenz in a script about the most privileged in our society pretending to be the most oppressed in our society. We were embarrassed for Taylor Lorenz. She spends her entire life on the internet. So of course, after a while, you become a deeply unhappy narcissist. That's what the internet does to people.
And the internet does other stuff to people. Like when the person that they worship, Tucker Carlson, tells them that this reporter is one of the most powerful people in the world, they then attack her and attack her and attack her. And that's what they've been doing, Bridget.
It's really sad to see. First of all, this is a pattern with Tucker Carlson. He's did it to Brandi Zadroni, the disinformation reporter at, I think, NBC. He singles out usually women journalists and just uses his massive platform to trash them. No one should go through this for just doing their job. And he seems to think it's funny. I think it's interesting in that clip that he kind of almost pretends that he doesn't know what he's doing. You know, like, oh, I'm just reporting on this journalist because she's privileged. Also, it's pretty funny that Tucker Carlson is, you know, taking on this stance of calling out the privileged. I didn't realize that he was this like downtrodden coal miner or something. Like, wow, you know, like this is news to me. But it really is very clearly harassment. What he's doing is a targeted, coordinated harassment campaign against a woman who was just trying to do her job. And all for what? Because she spoke up about facing harassment. Listen, as a woman on the internet, I can tell you it is not always pleasant. This kind of online harassment that's coordinated is often worse for women of color and black women. The data is very clear about that, but all women go through it and it shouldn't be this way. We shouldn't be harassed for just doing our job. And Tucker, honestly, like this is really saying something, him singling out women journalists just for doing their jobs, it is a new low for him. And that is really saying something.
100%. I want to take issue with two of the specific things he said in that video clip. First, he said, of course, if a mob of screaming lunatics showed up at your door, we would criticize that unconditionally. But would you? Because you had a chance to a couple months ago and you couldn't manage to do that with the Capitol attack. So I think your hypothetical has a couple of flaws in it. And the other is, and this is, I don't understand how someone can watch his show and see the things that he claims and not just be repulsed by how fundamentally intellectually dishonest it is. So he said, according to Taylor Lorenz, here's examples of what's harassment. For instance, saying mean things about her. She didn't claim that just saying mean things is harassment. Not affirming her as she self-actualizes. Did she say anything about that? Because according to Taylor Lorenz, he says, but she didn't say any of that. Again, this is him making up things and then attributing it to her. What she's actually saying isn't on its face ridiculous. So we need to attribute obviously ridiculous things she didn't say to her so that we, a group of men, can laugh at how ridiculous she is. That's the whole point of it. But there's a little bit more because, of course, he was criticized by the New York Times. They're making clear what the obvious effect of his coverage, if not the intent, and it's definitely the intent, is to produce more harassment. He is going to respond to that here.
When that tweet was written by a New York Times reporter, reading it out loud is a quote, calculated and cruel tactic. But calculated to do what exactly? Presumably calculated to get more people to disagree with Taylor Lorenz, which was they've already established is harassment.
Okay, so we know exactly what the point of both of those segments is. It is to get them to attack her online. That is why he keeps showing her picture, even though that's not her actual Twitter profile picture. He keeps saying her name over and over and over again. He keeps pretending that she's younger than she is for some reason. I don't understand that. It is to produce harassment, not to cause them to disagree. And I will say something that I said when we were talking about this yesterday with Anna Kasparian on the Young Turks. He keeps saying that fundamentally, they're conflating disagreement with harassment. It's not harassment, it's disagreement, he's saying. About what? Because we've now had two nights of coverage, and he will never define what they supposedly disagree about, except in theory, what counts as harassment. Now, I'm not interested in what he thinks counts as harassment, but that's what he would maybe say they disagree on. To which I would then say, so you disagree with a woman online about whether she's actually being harassed. And how does that justify two nights of coverage on the most watched cable news show on the internet? If that's the actual stakes, which he has to imply it is, that it's not just about harassment, it's about this honest disagreement. Why are you doing two nights of it? Isn't that weird? Isn't that by its very nature that you would devote so much of your time and attention and resources, literally having your producers, some of whom might be women, producing monologues designed to produce more harassment? Isn't that a bit out of scope with the stakes here? The stakes aren't the passage of a multi-trillion dollar aid bill. The stakes aren't access to reproductive rights or a person's ability to vote. It's she thinks she's being harassed and I think she's wrong. So I'm gonna take my massive media platform and devote multiple nights of attention. I guarantee tonight we'll have one as well. Bridget, that seems on its face more ridiculous than anything he is falsely asserting that she said.
It's completely ridiculous. And you put it so well, with everything else going on, you know, in the news, this deserves two nights of coverage. And all Taylor said was women shouldn't be harassed. And the fact that Tucker Carlson has to dedicate two nights of his huge popular show to that is wild to me. But again, I think it's really important that you pointed out that we're not talking about disagreement. We're talking about this like obsessive, like people, you know, because he seemed to say that, oh, Taylor thinks it's harassment to just use her name. I saw tweets directed at her that was just her name over and over and over again. That's not disagreement. What are they even disagreeing with her there?
I mean, I don't know.
Obviously not. You know, it's, if anything, the thing that they're disagreeing about is that she is allowed to take up space on the internet as a woman who is a journalist, right? Like, there's not anything that she is saying that anybody could meaningfully disagree with. The people who are responding to her are not disagreeing with, you know, the substance of what she's saying or an argument that she's making. I think that most women who are journalists online would welcome that kind of thing. But we need to be clear, this is not about disagreement or an exchange of ideas. This is harassment. And a lot of women who work in media, I'm sure women on the staff here at Young Turks can tell you all about it. Like, sometimes you're not even able to just put your opinion out there. And the fact that they're saying that her age is younger than she actually is, that whole bit about her being a deeply unhappy narcissist, Tucker needs to cut the BS. It's so clear what he's doing. He can do that sort of befuddled thing that he does where it's like, oh, what, me? I'm just putting a woman's picture on the screen and, you know, belittling her and calling her names to my, you know, millions of viewers. What am I doing wrong? It's so obvious. And I think I'm so happy that we're to a point where women are no longer being quiet about this. There was definitely a time, you know, not even that long ago, where if this kind of coordinated attack was happening to a female journalist, that her outlet might just say, you know, you're on your own. The fact that we're seeing the New York Times and NBC put out statements supporting their journalists when these kinds of things happen is a real, I think, in my mind, a step in the right direction, because even a few years ago, they would have said, oh, you're on your own, you know, good luck. And so I hope that women continue to speak up about the harassment that we face online, because it is a really serious issue and it's squashing speech. It's squashing our ability to just put our opinions out there online. And we're all supposed to be able to use our voices in that way. And so I certainly think what Tucker is doing is disgusting. And Taylor doesn't deserve this. No woman deserves this for trying to do her job.
For just existing.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, facing all this targeted harassment from guys that they couldn't disagree with her because they don't know anything about her work. They certainly haven't learned anything about it from Tucker Carlson. They just know that she's a woman. Tucker hates her. I guess I hate her too. And yeah, you're totally right. It's great that New York Times is sticking up for her. But I wonder, like, are there women waiting in the wings seeing this continued sight? Like, they spin a wheel, they land on a woman, they demonize her. Are some women potentially looking at that and saying, yeah, I'm not interested in that happening to me someday? Maybe media is not for me. Maybe I'll do media, but I won't be, you know, in a very visible position, because this is inevitably what's going to happen to me, that the right is going to, you know, in the moments they're not talking about Dr. Seuss, they're going to realize that they can make money and get clout off of demonizing me. I wonder.
I think that's exactly right. And I think that's the point of these kinds of attacks. They're meant to be a message to other women who might be interested in getting involved in media or using their voice or speaking up, that if you do this, this is what's going to happen to you. And not only will there be a network that amplifies it, people will make money from it. Tucker Carlson makes money. He profits personally from this kind of harassment. And I think it's meant to be a chilling thing for other women who might be thinking about, you know, whether it's running for office or, you know, going on television. I think it's meant to be a chilling signal that this kind of thing might happen to you.
If this bill is such a great thing for democracy, why did the Democrats pass it in the dead of night on a party line vote? Remember, even squishy moderates in the House GOP, they voted against it.
Okay, so that's Laura Ingraham talking about HR1, the both symbolically and in terms of when it's rolled out, most important bill for the Democrats. And that is a voting rights bill with a number of different aspects, which we've talked about. And there you have Laura Ingraham implying that because they passed it at night and because no Republicans supported it, how could it possibly be good? Which is an amazing bit of like circular logic. I didn't expect, Bridget, that many Republicans would support it, nor did I stake my evaluation of how good it is or how necessary it is to shore up voting rights in America based on whether it got any Republicans to support it. Did the lack of Republican support for HR1 bother you at all?
No, they don't support anything that's good. Of course not. They didn't support COVID relief.
They did not. Yeah, and so if they didn't support that as overwhelmingly positive or supported in the electorate that it is, I'm not surprised that they don't like this. But the thing is, we talked on the show yesterday about HR1. We showed you when Mike Lee, he was saying it was written in hell by the devil himself, that the actual components of it, even presented by Fox News, it's difficult to understand on its face why that would be something that people would oppose. And actually, it turns out, even when Laura Ingraham is trying to fearmonger about it, like listing what's in it, it really doesn't seem that scary yet either. But I'll let the audience decide as we watch this video.
Anyone with a tiny little brain sees this 800-page monstrosity. They see it has zero to do with empowering voters. Its sole purpose is to ensure a permanent Democrat majority, period. Now, HR1 takes a chainsaw to our constitutional order by ending state control over elections. And thus, it opens the door to rampant fraud and abuse. The bag of horribles, well, it mandates universal mail-in ballots, early voting, same-day voter registration, and online registration, and state voter ID laws would be banned entirely. States would even be prohibited from checking for duplicate voter registrations with other states within 6 months of an election. Oh, by the way, and ballot harvesting, that would be legalized nationwide. Good going. The bill also imposes nationwide automatic voter registration.
Not national voter registration. We'll say no more. Indeed, you don't have to say anymore. We all know how terrible that is. Look, I get if you watch the Fox Cinematic Universe, you get the reference. You don't need it laid out. But why is that on its face so bad? Why is online registration or whatever? Like, she makes so many claims that she doesn't even give like a Tucker Carlson sort of defense to. So it ends state level control, thus opening the door for fraud. Why does having one system invite obviously more fraud than having 50 plus systems? Like, she's making all these claims without actually defending them, and then just listing, I guess to her credit, the actual things that are in it. Those are actually things that are in the bill, assuming that we will fill it in with horror. And Bridget, I don't really get that.
Yeah, I mean, she lists what's in the bill. She says it's scary. You know, she says it with this sort of cadence as if she's reading a ransom note or something. Maybe just saying it's scary is going to be enough to have her audience be, you know, oh, the horror, people voting. Everything that she lists is just a way of making voting easier to access and available for more people. Early voting, vote by mail, online voting, all of these are things that just increase access to citizens being able to vote. So I guess that's terrifying to her and perhaps terrifying to her viewership, but nothing that she says is this bag of horribles that is, you know, warrants this kind of this kind of fear mongering that she's using when she speaks about it. You know, we're just talking about people being able to vote. We should, in a democracy, we should want more people voting, not less. We should want to eliminate barriers to voting, not put more up. I guess if you say it scary enough and you know, make it sound like you're talking about Dracula, maybe people will actually be afraid of it.
Exactly. And by the way, the bag of horribles is just a cheap knockoff of our Garbage People of the Week segment. But anyway, and look, at the beginning of her little thing there, she said HR 1 is not about helping voters. It's about ensuring permanent democratic control. So she asserts they say it's about this, but it's actually about this. And then she did she said everything that she did in that video, that it would make the registration easier, that you could do it online. So I ask you, which of those two things did the things she read lead to? It seems on its face like that would make voting easier. Even a conservative would probably prefer to register online rather than having to go to the DMV. But she asserts, no, in fact, it's about ensuring permanent control. Did any of the things she say naturally lead to democratic control forever? I mean, maybe you could try to make the case of why you think that's a consequence, but it's not on its face a consequence. So she isn't even buttressing her own argument there. She's in fact buttressing the one that she started off the segment by trying to say is invalid.
Yeah, and I mean, if she believes that these policies will lead to quote permanent democratic control, she needs to explain why having people be able to vote early is going to lead to that. But I can't figure out why that is, and I think it just goes back to this big lie that has been now been sort of like mainstreamed on platforms like Fox News, that the election was rigged or stolen, or that, you know, there's some sort of widespread voting irregularities happening, which we know is not the case. And so, you know, this is just more fear mongering about an issue that really is not a big deal. Like, what she is talking about is expanding access to voting, which should be a good thing. The fact that she seems to be so terrified by it, I think, is really telling.
Yeah. And you know, like, I'm wondering if maybe they deserve a little bit of odd credit, because in the run up to the November election, they were demonizing mail voting and early voting. And we said, and everyone said, you idiots, that's gonna lead to your voters doing less of it, and that's probably gonna hurt you. So then we had an election, and that totally came true. And they're still demonizing those. Like, in theory, they could pivot and they could be like, oh, whoops, actually, we kind of want to win elections. So, no, if you could vote early, please vote early. And if you can vote by mail and that's the only way you're going to vote, definitely do that. But they're not pivoting. they seem to still believe, even with all of the evidence of that last election and the runoffs in Georgia, that demonizing those things is somehow more beneficial than trying to get their own voters to do them. And that's a risky gamble. Yeah. Well, look, nowhere does Laura Ingraham's attacks against HR1 make less obvious sense than when she talks about the effect it would have on youth voting or trying to get young people interested in politics, as she talks about here.
But perhaps the most insidious aspect of HR1 is the targeting of our kids. The bill forces states to accept voter registrations from 16-year-olds, even though they can't legally vote. The bill also turns colleges and universities into government-funded voter mills. HR1 creates campus vote coordinators, and those are positions and they hand out cash to schools that register students. In other words, schools that churn out the most Democrat voters.
Bridget, your thoughts?
I don't even know what she's talking about. You know, first of all, her talking about registering 16-year-olds. So actually, there are some places like Hyattsville, Maryland, Tacoma Park, Maryland, where 16-year-olds actually can vote in local elections. And so that's not that unusual. And just registering 16-year-olds to vote doesn't mean that they are then able to vote in, you know, presidential elections if they're not 18. So her fear-mongering about that is just completely based, it's a complete fabrication. And then this idea of college campuses being turned into government mandated voter mills, I have no idea what she means other than people will help college students get registered to vote, which should be a good thing. I mean, it really is just her fear mongering and using this kind of bogus, like, oh, think about the children. Won't someone please think of the children narrative to scaremonger about something that I think is obviously a pretty good thing.
Yeah, she starts off with they're targeting our kids by giving money to register them to vote. Wait, no, but that doesn't, how's that targeting? That's like saying like Kids R Us is targeting our kids. Well, it's about kids, I guess. I don't know. Is Harry Potter targeting our kids? I don't understand what you're talking about, except that it's trying to play into, oh, it's about the kids. And it's a voter mill because they'll register them. She doesn't even imply that they're, that as part of that funding, they would be indoctrinated to support one party or another. There's not even an attempt like anything like that. Nor is there an attempt to explain why Republicans aren't interested in trying to appeal to those voters. As with all of their other arguments against voting, they never actually grapple with the possibility that fighting voting isn't the only option. That in theory, they're big boys and girls, they could try to appeal to those people. They could, I don't know, like support a policy that people actually like. They could identify, recognize, and try to solve a problem that might be facing young people. But there's no attempt to even do it. There's no acknowledgement that that's even an option that they could engage with. It's just, it's objectively bad that these young people might be registered so that someday they can legally vote. That's a terrible thing. And we want to scare you with that.
Yeah, and really honestly, listening to that clip, this is voting dis and misinformation just pumped right into people's faces, pumped right into like the faces of people who are already indoctrinated by this kind of thinking. And I think it's so irresponsible to put this on the air. You know, reading it is one thing, but hearing the way she says it and knowing that millions of Americans are getting this pumped into their homes every night and perhaps not questioning the things that she says, this is a disinformation campaign that is meant to really have a negative impact on our democracy. And it's just so irresponsible.
Yeah. And you know what? Yeah, it is. And so let's acknowledge one of those negative impacts. And this is just one, by the way, one thing that HR1 is trying to fight against, that all of these state level laws to fight against voting, like the ones we talked about recently in Iowa and Georgia, which have already been signed, let alone the more than 200 plus other ones that haven't yet been signed, but could do a lot of damage to voting rights. Let's talk about one area of it. And that is racist gerrymandering. So the redistricting that followed the 2010 census, the last time we have this, resulted in, quote, some of the most gerrymandered and racially discriminatory maps in history. But the next cycle of redistricting could be even more fraught with abuse in southern states, according to a new report from the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University Law School. Florida, Texas, and North Carolina, all of which are expected to gain House seats following the 2020 census, as well as Georgia, pose the highest risk of producing maps that are racially discriminatory and favor Republicans. One of those states has already had a bill in this area passed. Now, what does this have to do with HR1? Well, HR1, in addition to all the other things we've talked about, public financing, cybersecurity, registration, all that stuff, also fights back against gerrymandering by establishing an independent commission, which, by the way, some states already have. This would be a federal one, to use scientific metrics of inequity in racial representation based on voter preferences. And so it would stop some of the most extreme racist gerrymandering, which previously things like the Voting Rights Act might have stopped before that was completely defanged by the Supreme Court. So this could be very important, not just in all those other ways, but specifically in stopping some of the most racist voter suppression that we've seen.
Yeah, I'm happy to see that. I think that it's so necessary, and it's not surprising to me that people like Laura Ingraham think it's so terrible. I think we have a long way to go in terms of restoring everyone's access to voting in this country. And it's so clear to me that, you know, the people who are most harmed are Black and Brown communities who have not really always had an easy go of it, making our voices heard with our vote. And so I am all for, you know, looking into gerrymandering and the way that it is really harmed our community's ability to, like, you know, just express our democracy via voting. And I guess Laura Ingraham can just stay mad about it.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, everyone, that is all of the Fox News we're gonna give you. It is also, unfortunately, though, all of the show that we have. But I believe, Bridget, we do have a little promo for your podcast that people can know a little bit about that. Is that ready to go, team? Do we not have that, unfortunately? Oh, I thought we were gonna have that, unfortunately. Well, the podcast is There Are No Girls on the Internet. Bridget, it has been great to have you. The response from the audience has been awesome. And hopefully we'll have you back sometime very soon.
Anytime, this was so fun.
Well, and by the way, we don't have that promo, but where can people find your podcast if they wanna see more of your work?
Yeah, it's on the iHeartRadio network. You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcast on.
Awesome, Bridget, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
A group of progressive Democrats have introduced a bill to try to end qualified immunity. And joining us now to discuss is the politics reporter at The Intercept, Kay Lacy. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me, John.
Always glad to have you here. So you had a write-up about this at The Intercept, and we're talking about Representative Ayanna Pressley as well as Senators Markey and Warren. But tell us a little bit about this. Where did this come from and what current state is it at?
So Rep. Ayanna Pressley and former Congressman Justin Amash introduced a similar bill as a similar ending qualified immunity bill last year, last session, as an amendment to the Justice and Policing Act. And it ended up not being included in that bill for some of the same reasons that there's some pushback to this this bill and a similar provision in the JPA this year, which I can explain. Basically, so the backstory to this is that, you know, the issue of qualified immunity, which is a legally created doctrine, basically, that shields police officers from civil liability in cases where they violate a person's constitutional rights. This is something that has been sort of codified into practice through a series of legal cases. It's not something that is a written law. And for part of that is part of the reason that there's been sort of a bipartisan push to end or severely or significantly reform this doctrine. So we're talking about the ACLU, the Cato Institute, Tom Brady led a group of NFL players who wrote a letter, you know, pushing to end qualified immunity in recent years. And even Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas has expressed support for, you know, reforming this
really?
Concept. Yes. And so that's what makes this even more interesting is that sort of in you know, all the back and forth over the uprisings against police brutality this summer, backlash to calls to defund the police, this issue of qualified immunity has sort of been railroaded into this discourse around police reform and has become sort of a lightning rod to the point where, you know, it was a bipartisan issue that is now sort of becoming like a Rorschach test for where you stand on policing. And so
Let me ask you about that, because obviously you talked about the difficulties before when it had tried to be passed, and now we have it trying once again, and there's some, as you said, it's a lightning rod. Now, in between those, we had obviously a lot of social events going on in this sort of area. So has it become less bipartisan? Have some of the people on the other side perhaps shied away now that ending qualified immunity might be lumped in with this sort of generalized approach to reform to the police?
Yeah, and one great example of this is that a Republican senator had introduced a bill to end qualified immunity last year, and ended up, he went on Tucker Carlson's show and promptly got a bunch of pushback from police unions and police officers and ended up pulling the bill. And so, and again, Justin Amash had co-introduced this with Ayanna Pressley last session. Now it's being reintroduced only with Democratic senators and representatives. And another sort of tag on this is that this bill is separate from a provision in the Justice and Policing Act that would also limit qualified immunity, but not totally end it. But the push on this has become so polarizing that we have House members like Josh Gottheimer and Tom O'Halloran, the latter who is a former police officer and the former who is one of the top recipients of police money in Congress, were pushing to water down the qualified immunity provision in the JPA, which doesn't even really do all that much anyway. We had people talking about this as, deciding on qualified immunity as being made to walk the plank during the House Democratic caucus call after midterms last year. And so, to your point, it has become a less bipartisan issue solely because it's been sort of wrapped up in all of this discourse around whether or not police reforms are going too far. Yeah.
And by the way, so I saw your reference in the article to the individuals like, I'm not going to walk the plank. And you got to love that as like, what a cowardly little excuse when what's at stake is the ability of people to get away with murder effectively. Like, well, okay, I don't want to walk planks either, but if I were to walk a plank, this seems like the sort of thing that it might be worthwhile to do it on when people's lives are at stake. But anyway, I did want to ask you about the various watered down versions. So you alluded to the fact that the watered down version doesn't accomplish nearly as much, but is it, I don't know how easy it is to quickly sum up, what is the major difference? How much more open with the watered down version would police be to any sort of legal consequences versus the current status quo?
So basically, and I'm not sure that they actually succeeded in watering down the provision in JPA any more than it already was. So Ayanna Pressley's bill would fully end this practice. Like, it would end the ability for police officers to claim qualified immunity in defense in cases where they've violated someone's rights. The version in JPA would allow people the possibility to get some of their damages back in these cases. So doesn't mean that police officers can't use it as a defense, but it opens up a small window of opportunity for you to be able to recover some sort of damages if you actually are in a suit like this. Another piece of information that I think is important to note is that this doctrine is used in situations to deter families from even thinking about bringing cases. So this is what happened with the case of Elijah McClain. I believe he was a 26 or 27 year old young man in Colorado who was apprehended by police and given an extremely overdose of ketamine and died. And his family was, there was some reporting, I believe it was in The Week, about this, that basically his family was hesitant about even bringing the case. There was some talk about whether or not they should even bring charges, because if police officers would be able to use qualified immunity as a defense in this case for administering the ketamine and things like that. So it's used, to keep people from being able to have due process, and also to even deter people from even thinking about pushing back against cases where police officers violate their rights. Yeah.
Well, finally, I wanted to ask you, you alluded to the fact that it's lost some of the Republican support. What about Democrats? Like, how unified are they? How likely is this, like, never mind the Senate, how likely is this to pass in the House?
Yeah, so that's part of another you reminded me I should mention this, that Ayanna Pressley basically voted in favor of the Justice and Policing Act in exchange for the House Judiciary Committee agreeing to hold a series of hearings on police reforms. They got agreement to 3 hearings, one of which would be a markup on this bill. All that to say that there is not a huge chance of it passing. There is not unity within the Democratic Party on this. Some of the pushback was coming from, you know, some of the most, you know, hardline moderates and centrists in the party, who have gotten away with sort of using the push for police reform as an excuse for backlash to pushes for police reform as an excuse to not move on these things. So that all to say that there will be a markup of this bill at some point. It's unclear whether it will actually pass the House. Mm. I think you can assume what that means for its passage in the Senate. But the fact that it was introduced at all is a benchmark for at least some sort of progress that's being made, whether or not it goes anywhere.
Yeah, it's awesome that they're pushing for it. It could be, you know, in theory, were it to pass, it would be an amazing product of, you know, all that's happened socially and politically over the past year. Unfortunately, it's taking place in America, and so it's looking like a lot of other awesome things that could pass, that it's going to have a difficult road. But we certainly appreciate both your work in writing this up for The Intercept, and everyone should definitely take a look at that, as well as joining us. As always, Akela, we really appreciate you joining us.
Thank you, John. A pleasure to be here, as always.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.